I'd like now to welcome to the program Steve Paxton. He's a musician, composer, and teacher, and he is working with Santa Fe New Music, which is presenting the Southwest Festival of New Music, a three-day event that examines the theme of music as environmental consciousness. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm there, Charlotte. Thanks.
It's great to have you back on the show.
Sure.
Now, you are in this festival, among other things, really paying tribute to the work of John Cage. Is that correct?
That's right. John Cage was born in 1912, so we're celebrating the centenary of his birth. And there are a few John Cage pieces on the concert. Like there are four concerts altogether, and the first two feature a work by John Cage. But primarily, it's music by other composers who take a similar approach or have a similar philosophy about composition and music as did John Cage.
How would you characterize that approach that John Cage was doing and that people have been influenced by?
There are a lot of ways to think about it, but one is to think of a composer as being more of an observer and an appreciator that leads audience members into observation and appreciation, rather than a composer being an all-powerful entity that creates a sound world of their own making. John Cage, the philosophy of John Cage is more leading an audience, leading other musicians into an experience where they observe music happening and appreciate it.
Now, that does call into the question of what you mean by music.
Right. To take this particular festival's theme as sort of a jumping off point, we're calling the festival Music as Environmental Consciousness. So it sort of suggests the idea of music that's about nature or that's about our environment. So if you think through music history, there are lots of composers that have done this from the Renaissance period, certainly in the Baroque era with Vivaldi's Seasons, and then the Romantic and classical era with Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, and with Debussy's La Mer. Lots of composers who have taken fairly traditional musical styles and imprinted some sort of nature story on top of the music, which is beautiful, and audiences have always loved that. What's different about the John Cage approach is he's not necessarily saying that it takes a composer to create a musical world that has nature built into it, because we already have that musical world out there. That musical world of nature, not just nature, but all of our environment, that world is out there, and it doesn't require a composer to create it. What it really requires is an audience to go out and to observe it and appreciate it and to pay attention to it and to respect it and to be involved with that environment that's already there.
I think John Cage's most well-known piece is 4 minutes and how many seconds?
Some 33
seconds. I was thinking of it as 4.5 minutes of silence, in which the audience, basically the musician, sits down at the piano or whatever instrument and doesn't play it, and then the audience has to basically listen to what ambient sounds are in the room, and maybe their own breathing, and maybe shuffling and coughing or whatever. And what is that experience like when you have heard that, if we can call it composition? I'm not sure we can, but what has your experience been of that piece?
Well, it's always controversial and confrontational, well, depending on what kind of audience is there for it. But it's a composer who's forcing an issue. It's not a composition that's all about the way that it sounds, but it's a composition that's all about the philosophy behind it. So, you know, if you confront, we don't always want to be confronted with difficult notions about what is art and what is music, and that's one of the pieces that really forces us to sort of tackle that issue.
So again, it forces you to tackle that issue, but I guess what I'm trying to ask is, when you have actually sat down in a room where one of the pieces on the program is 4.5 minutes of silence by John Cage, and you, Steve Paxton, are sitting in a chair, what happens?
You observe the results.
You.
Yeah, I observe the results. And the results are the environment. That is our us being conscious of our environment. And me being conscious of my environment is what happens in a performance of 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Now, a lot of people would have a different reaction. They would feel like it was an opportunity for them to become angry at the composer for not really doing very much, or at whoever organized the concert for perpetrating a fraud of some sort. But there is this world of sound around us that doesn't take composers getting their hands on and messing with to really be an interesting environment of sound. And so it's possible for us to just sit back and relax and observe that that environment. I heard someone mention on another program, they were talking about a tour at the Botanical Garden, at the Santa Fe Botanical Garden. And I think the name of the tour or the name of the lecture or something was called something like Solitude and Perfection. And I'm thinking that is an that's a John Cage musical experience, is to experience solitude and perfection in the same way that you might experience the beautiful sights and aromas of a flower garden. You didn't create those flowers. You might have sort of arranged how they're placed in the garden, but you were not responsible for creating that beauty. You just gathered people together to share that beauty, to share the solitude and perfection of that natural occurrence.
John Cage was a very serious student of Zen practice, and I find myself wondering, with the piece you're describing and others in a similar vein, how is the piece different from meditation, if it is?
It may be different in that it's more confrontational and it's more sort of academic in a strange sort of way.
Because, of course, the audience didn't sign up to do a meditation.
Right, right. They didn't. The audience was not co-conspirators in the performance necessarily. They were more like victims, or the audience is put on the spot. And a lot of times, that's sort of the paradox with not just John Cage's music, but with a lot of experimental music. It may be promoting the idea of solitude or of open-mindedness or of a holistic idea about music, or about art in general. But at the same time, it does kind of put people on the spot in a little bit of an aggressive kind of way. Not quite like shaking your finger at someone and saying, you really ought to appreciate this. But there is just a touch of that in the world of John Cage, that sort of didactic saying, you probably don't appreciate the sound world around you very much, so I'm going to put you in a situation where you have to confront it whether you want to or not.
And yet, there's also a kind of loving and, for lack of a better word, humorous element to the whole thing.
Well, and that's the particular aspect of John Cage himself and of his music that I find the most intriguing. He was such a gentle man.
Yeah.
And so quiet and patient. He never imagined that his music had to replace all the music of the past.
I should hope not.
No, of course not.
Nobody imagines that.
Well, there might be people who do, but certainly he was not. He had this sense of humor and no ego whatsoever. And the whole idea of composing is sort of an egotistical endeavor where you create a world all of your own, a little sound world. Well, when we go about creating worlds, we're putting ourselves in kind of a self-centered, we're putting ourselves on a higher plane if we think of ourselves as world creators. Well, a composer who says, no, I'm not creating worlds, I'm just pointing them out to my audience members and the musicians so that they can appreciate those worlds that already exist, that's a complete denial of self and of ego. And that's what John Cage teaches us every time we hear one of his performances.
We're talking to Steve Paxton about John Cage and about the upcoming Southwest Festival of New Music, which is What, this coming weekend?
It is. Well, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Four concerts in 3 days.
And where is it all happening?
All of the concerts are at CCA, Center for Contemporary Arts, over on Old Pecos Trail. Thursday night at 7:30, Friday night also at 7:30, and Saturday night at 7:30. There's also a late-night Friday concert that starts at 10 o'clock that's all electronic music.
So I was wondering, for you as a composer, walking as everybody does in the shadow of those who have come before you, or whatever the metaphor is, I don't know if it's a shadow, but do you think about music maybe that you're composing that has sheet music and instruments and times and time signatures and all of that? Do you think about, for example, the room in which it's going to be played? I mean, do you think about, because of John Cage, a kind of bigger context for it?
Sometimes. More typically, the type of room that it's going to be played in and the type of audience that might be there, rather than the specific room. But if you're thinking of pieces, lots of times new music concerts take place in galleries or maybe in outdoor spaces or in somewhat non-traditional spaces. And so you can deal with technology a little bit differently if you can place speakers around the audience or maybe outdoors as the audience is coming in. So there are just ways to reimagine the performing experience, the music experience, based on what kind of environment it's presented in.
Working with the music of John Cage as a professor, as you are teaching your students, and as a composer and a musician and as a person who enjoys music, which I'm none of those things. I'm just an enjoyer of music, nothing more. I would think that I would get bored with that and want to go back to composers who composed things that I could listen to. Mm-hmm. Because after a while, listening to the music of everyday life, if you can, again, I'm not positive that you can call it music. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. I'd rather actually listen to salsa or listen to Beethoven.
Well, there's lots of music out there, and there's, 24 hours a day. There's time to listen to Beethoven and salsa music and Edgard Varèse and Mary Charlotte's Radio Cafe show, and there's time to do all of that. And there's time to make observations and appreciate things that you've never experienced before. And maybe just a little bit of your time is reserved for that. Maybe just a small fraction of your yearly artistic experience is set aside for completely new confrontations. And maybe the rest of that time you're more in a comfort zone. And I don't see anything wrong with that. And personally, the music that I compose is pretty traditional when compared to a lot of contemporary music, because I'm sort of like you. I really like folk music. I like certain rock music. A lot of my students at the college are singer-songwriters, and I really appreciate the sort of alternate alt-rock singer-songwriter kind of stuff that they do. And then every once in a while, I want to do something that's really off the wall, that's more experimental, and that sort of adds a little bit of an edge to the experience of being a musician or being a composer.
There is the title of this festival, Music as Environmental Consciousness, which does lead one to think about, and as does John Cage's music, the subject of awareness. And I think the more you become aware of little things like blades of grass or animals, or, I mean, I'm still reeling with shock and horror and sorrow about the fact that they took the prairie dogs out of the park near where I live, and I miss these creatures. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's such a lack of awareness that says that you can't share your world with these beautiful and helpful animals. And it's sort of like the more aware you become of your environment, in a way, the less able you are to harm it.
Yeah, and that's the I don't know if that's the lesson of John Cage, but maybe that's what almost all music is about, is being put in a situation where you can be more attentive to things that you would normally ignore. As a composer, one of the problems that you're confronted with is how to create music that people can't ignore, because there's such a long history of music and we're surrounded by music all the time. A lot of it just passes right by our ears and we don't recognize that it's even there. Sometimes a composer has to take a really radical step away from musical tradition just to make sure that somebody's listening, and just to make sure that someone is maybe attentive to sounds or artistic structures that maybe they would otherwise have ignored. So I think on these concerts there'll be a lot of pieces that that create situations where audiences gradually are encouraged to become very attentive on very subtle musical and sound details.
It's interesting because when you say music you can't ignore, I think of there was a period in art where people were increasingly trying to make art that you couldn't ignore, which ended up having a sort of shock value, which then got old and boring because everybody was doing things that were designed to shock, and nothing shocked anybody anymore.
Right. And so you're talking about subtlety can be very shocking in that context.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Steve Paxton, there's a whole group of people coming in to play music by various composers, including John Cage, but also a lot of people playing their own music. How do some of these composers and performers approach this idea of music as environmental consciousness? I imagine there's a whole bunch of different approaches.
There are, and a lot of them are really just kind of technical issues related to music notation. You know, what does a musical score look like? And if we're used to taking maybe a two-part invention by Bach and setting it on the piano in front of us and trying to struggle through playing all of those notes and all of those rhythms just in the way that Bach wrote them, if you've done that before, you kind of understand the power that Johann Sebastian Bach has over every single person that sits down and tries to play that music.
Right.
And part of it's because the notation is so specific for what Bach wanted. He wanted specific notes to happen at very specific times. A lot of the music by the composers on this concert, not all of it, but a lot of it is notated in a way that leaves the performer a lot more freedom. There might be specific notes indicated on a musical staff, but they might just be sort of spaced out on the page without specific rhythms. Or in some cases, the specific notes might not be specified at all, but certain rhythms would be specified. And there, in some cases, there are just no notes or rhythms at all would be specified, but rather some general instructions for performers to play fast figures in a high range until they hear another performer play a long, low note, at which point the first performer does something else. So, you know, sets of instructions, almost like instructions for playing a game, sort of like a game theory type of.
Now, one of the questions I have is, let's say you have a piece like that that's based on these instructions, mm-hmm. and the instructions are like, play a long, low note and all of that.
Yep.
Now, I mean, David Dunn, violin virtuoso, he's one of the people in that, not right. doing that kind of work anymore, but to what extent is it important that performers in pieces like what you just mentioned have a background in traditional music and have that craft and have the chops and can play those instruments really well?
Well, it may or may not be important. It depends on the piece, because each piece can have its own sort of requirements. Like one of the John Cage pieces on the festival is composed, or it's going to be performed by four people playing conch shells. Well, none of those four people are virtuoso conch shell players. They just happen to have the conch shells, have been given the conch shells with the right pitch, and they understand the notation, and then it's up to them to create an interesting musical performance.
But the fact that they're musical performers probably gives them an edge over if I pick that thing up.
Oh, well, probably. It might. But it might not. I mean, it's when you, if you say music for the masses and think that that means this is music that anybody could play, it doesn't take a trained professional to perform this music, that's not always the case, but sometimes it is the case, and what would be wrong with that? If you could create a musical composition that anybody off the street could walk in and perform and take pleasure in performing it, wouldn't that be a nice thing?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think there's something, for example, when you watch the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet, there are people on that stage doing things that none of us can do. And there's a beauty in watching people who've devoted their entire lives to that level of training.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I just...
But there's also a beauty to watching a child play in a sand pile, or to watching a puppy or a kitten romp about in very balletic sorts of ways. And they're untrained, but there's a beauty to what they can do physically that is comparable to what a trained ballet dancer can do. And it's not a substitute for it. I'm not saying we have to have one or the other, but we can appreciate that expertise, whether it's innate or learned.
We're talking to Steve Paxton. Talk about some of the other composers in the upcoming festival, the Southwest mm-hmm. Festival of New Music, Music as Environmental Consciousness.
Well, there are four composers who've actually been commissioned by Santa Fe New Music to create new works specifically for this festival. And one of those is Christian Wolf, who is the only surviving member of John Cage's little circle of composers that was very active in New York City in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Christian Wolf is very elderly now. He was not able, he was going to come for the festival, but was not able to come. But he has composed a new piece entitled Santa Fe that will be performed on the festival. The other composers are completely different generation of composers who are in their 20s and 30s who are working in the new music world in a 21st century sort of way, as opposed to, you know, the direct compatriots of John Cage. They're Lisa Coombs, Nathan Davis, and Christopher Marianetti. Marianetti is actually from Albuquerque. I think he's based in New York City now, but he has roots to New Mexico.
Steve, you're one of the people, you're one of the composers who is going to be playing music on Thursday, yep. June 21st at 7:30. Can we hear a little bit of your music?
Sure. This is a piece called Woods Mix, and it evolves slowly, much in the way that if you were walking through a forest and you heard sounds around you changing slightly as you made progress through the forest. Things don't change suddenly. All of a sudden you don't hear a C major chord from the trumpet section, because in the forest there's no trumpet section. But instead you hear rhythmic patterns created by animals or footsteps. You hear slowly evolving sound structures changing. And this is just an excerpt that sort of reflects that approach to composition.
Let's hear it. Thank you. and that is Woods Mix by Steve Paxton. So anything else you want to let people know about the upcoming festival?
Well, all of these concerts take place at 7:30. They're at CCA. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Plus, there's a late-night concert on Friday that starts at 10.
What's that?
It's all electroacoustic, live performance electroacoustic pieces by the guest composers. One of the things that's possible, that's more and more possible with new technology, is to do really interesting live performances with technology in just as musical a way as we use guitars and violins and things. People now can use laptops and microphones
right.
and things like that.
No dancing, though.
Dancing is not prohibited. I don't see anywhere in the publicity that prohibits dancing.
So we should. Do you think this music will give rise to
it
dancing?
It might. We just have to observe. We have to experience the environment and observe what happens.
Excellent. Well, Steve Paxton is a musician, composer, teacher, and he's part of the Santa Fe New Music presentation of the Southwest Festival of New Music. It's a 3-day event, Music as Environmental Consciousness. For more information, you can go to SFNM, which stands for Santa Fe New Music, sfnm.org. And you can also check out ccasantafe.org. Steve Paxton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'd like now to welcome Doug Ryan. He is a member of the Sierra Club and of the editorial team for the new edition of the book Day Hikes in the Santa Fe Area. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, thank you. It's great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So this book, I think I bought an early edition of it when I moved here probably about 20 years ago, that was much slimmer than this book.
Much slimmer. The first edition came out in 1981, and it was just a group of Sierra Club members that got together and decided that we needed a guide for our hiking, and they all had favorite hikes, so they each wrote up their favorite hikes. And it was a slimmer volume, but it's the backbone, that's the spine of the subsequent editions that have come in the book. We're now in our 7th edition. We think we've probably altogether sold close to 50,000 copies of the combined editions through the years.
They're very useful because, first of all, they tell you how to get there and wherever these hikes are, and some of them it's not obvious unless you have the directions. And also, you can really decide what you're going to do on the basis of whether it's a very strenuous or an easier hike, depending on how you feel and who you're with and all of that, and how strong your dogs are. But also based on season. So there's a lot of things that go into, from the user's perspective, using this book.
We've tried to make it as useful as possible, and useful not just to experienced hikers, but to beginning hikers, intermediate hikers, and experienced hikers. A little bit of something for everyone, and as you mentioned, seasons, length, the altitude, how much climb there is, all of that is really important to gauging the strenuousness of a hike, obviously.
Are all of these hikes on public lands?
They are, for the most part, on public lands. There are certain hikes where there's been a negotiated easement through private property that's part of the hike, but our hats are off and our thanks go out to those private property owners who have made those hikes possible, because some of the nicest hikes are use that private easement.
So that said, there's a lot of different kinds of public land that we're talking about, from BLM land to Hyde Park and
National Forest, national monuments, and really state parks. So yes, there's a lot of public lands, and the public lands that belong to us, and thankfully they're out there for us to use.
So each time you do a new edition, are there actually new hikes that somebody has found? Are there actually new trails that weren't there before that are going into the book?
Funny you should ask that. When we started on this edition, the whole idea, we were about sold out of the 6th edition, so the whole idea was really just to redo the 6th edition, just update it, make sure that everything was accurate, keep the same hikes in there. And we had been working on it for about 6 months. Rehiking, we actually rehike all of the hikes to make sure that the descriptions are accurate, that the cairn that was at that intersection was still there, and that
right.
kind of thing.
And nobody's built a house in the middle of it.
Exactly. Suddenly there's a tree falling across that you can't get across, whatever. But in the middle of last summer, of course, we had these tremendous wildfires in the Santa Fe area. And we had to step back and say, wow, this is going to have a tremendous impact on hiking opportunities. So we had to just go back and reconsider. What happened was that there were five or six hikes that we just had to take out of the old book. So in order to kind of make up for that, we put in a few new hikes. We reconfigured some of the hikes. But most importantly, we went to all of these, and I don't call them hikes so much as destinations. Each of the 56 chapters or destinations in the book, most of them have multiple hikes that you can do. You can do a short hike, a short out and back, or a loop hike, or different kinds of hikes that you can do. And we've added quite a few of those little options within each destination.
Or you can do as I've done on at least one or two occasions, which is think you're doing the smaller loop and
and make the wrong turn and get a really good day's exercise.
Exactly.
Right.
We once hiked long after sunset in the snow because I missed the turn back.
Well, hopefully you just didn't read the description carefully enough.
No, I didn't. I wasn't using your book at all. It was one of those things. Here's the thing. You think you know. Because you've done it so many times.
Right.
And then it's a different season or something looks different or it's grown differently and you miss your
turn. Or the lighting gets different as the sun sets. So that can be a very tricky time. Dawn and dusk are very tricky times to hike. You have to really be careful.
Now, do you have in your book whether or not it's a dog-friendly hike?
We do. We have, of course, in most of the national forests, you can, in BLM land, you can take dogs. But there are quite a few places where you shouldn't take dogs, and in places where you should have dogs on leash. So,
going hiking with a dog on a leash is sort of defeats the purpose.
It's not what most dog owners like, I think, but there are certain...
Or not to mention the dogs.
Right, but there are certain trails where really you have to be out of consideration to the other hikers and the other walkers. There are a lot of trails in the Dale Ball area, for instance, where basically dogs are allowed off-leash, but really there are a lot of hikers there, and dog owners really need to be conscientious and considerate of the others as well.
There have been some problems, too.
There have been dog attacks and dog bites in various places in the area. But most dogs are wonderful and great to have on the trail, and I love meeting a happy, friendly dog and when I'm out hiking. So, let's keep the dogs happy, too.
We're talking to Dag Ryan about the book Day Hikes in the Santa Fe Area. It's the 7th edition, revised and updated. Now, do you have some favorites? Do you have places that you keep going back to? Do you like doing different hikes each time you go out?
Until I started talking to people about this book, I'd really never thought about what were my favorites. But that being said, in thinking about it, there's two hikes that I do really enjoy as much as anything, and that's basically the hike to Deception Peak in the summer, going up to the Wilderness Gate and up Ravens Ridge to Deception Peak. It's the quickest way to get above the tree line near Santa Fe. It's right from the ski basin, and it's really wonderful. You get up there on a clear day like today or yesterday, and you can see forever. It's just glorious. Another favorite of mine is the Santa Barbara hike, where you're in this wonderful, beautiful valley with a creek running through it. And at the end of the valley, you always have this gorgeous mountain, Chimayosos Peak, framed in the valley the entire distance. And it's just really a beautiful, beautiful hike.
Let's talk for a moment about safety. I sort of think that for day hikes, unless it's really cold, you don't have to worry about too much except maybe having something to drink with you. But what do you think are the safety precautions that people should take when going for a day hike?
Number one is obviously to have enough water. We live at a high altitude, and people get dehydrated very, very quickly. So bringing enough water, and particularly on summer hikes when the sun is out and when it's hot, is critical. The second most important thing in my mind is to be aware of the weather. Weather can change very rapidly, and if you're hiking above the tree line in the mountains in the Sangres, hiking up to Baldy or Deception Peak or any of those places, the weather can change just on a dime. And so it's really critical for you to keep an eye out and not get caught in lightning storms or hailstorms at those high altitudes. The third thing is really just know your own abilities. Be aware of what kind of hike is comfortable for you, and particularly at this altitude. I mean, we start out at 7,000 feet here in Santa Fe, and we go up to 12,000, 13,000 feet. So knowing how much of a climb you can take is really important, because you don't want to get exhausted and start cramping when you're 6 miles away from the trailhead.
And if you're doing, as I often do, the Tusuki Creek, for example,
right,
and you just sort of walk out, and eventually you have to decide when you're going to turn around and come back.
Exactly.
And you have to make sure that you're not fully exhausted before you turn around.
You do. Unfortunately, on most of those kinds of hikes, it's downhill on the way home. So,
well, yeah.
So that helps too. But yeah, always turn around before you get exhausted. Know what your limitations are. That's critical.
Another thing that I've noticed too is in the fall, if you go up to the ski basin or that area, going up that hill, and it's late, it's in the afternoon, you go up at 3 o'clock or something like that, the temperature can drop so much by the time you're done. And it's warm summer weather on the plaza, and you need a down jacket up there.
Right, right. And those temperature changes are really important because they can contribute to the snow and the ice that's up there way into June and starting already in September. There have been places that we've been hiking where we think it's a lovely summer day, and suddenly you come up on a steep section of the trail downhill that's just slick, slick ice.
Right.
So you just have to watch out for that kind of thing.
Are there places that you've been that are in this book where you think there's a danger of getting lost?
I think if we have done our job well enough and people have read the instructions and looked at the maps, and let me mention about the maps, several of the maps, about a dozen of the maps for this book have been updated and revised, and we're really grateful to Greg Olson at the Travel Bug, who does all of these maps for us for free. And that's really a wonderful contribution to the book. But you have to read where you're going, know where you're going, and look carefully at the map so that you have an idea. A lot of people today use GPS. It's not really that difficult to learn how to use a GPS, and that can be a big help as well.
You can also, if you don't want to lug the book around in your backpack or whatever, you can just copy the two or three pages.
Exactly. That's what we do. And every time we go out, we just copy that particular hike, stick it in our back pocket, and then we can toss it. That way the book doesn't get all crumpled and rained on either.
Right. The book is called Day Hikes in the Santa Fe Area, and Dog Ryan is a member of the Sierra Club, which puts this wonderful book out, the Northern New Mexico group of the Sierra Club, and he's on the editorial team for the new edition of the book, which is available, what, everywhere? Everywhere in Santa Fe that sells books, pretty
everywhere
much.
That sells books, at certainly at the Travel Bug, at the Garcia Street bookstores, and at
REI,
Collected Works.
The hiking stores.
The hiking outfitters, and a lot of the at the national monuments, at Bandelier, at Petroglyph National Monument, the gift shops and bookstores at those places sell the book.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to have been here. Thanks.
We have a little time left in the program, and so in honor of Father's Day, I'm going to play a piece I wrote some years ago as a remembrance of my own father, Mario Domandi. The piece was recorded by Judy Goldberg and has aired on Backroads Radio here on KSFR. I was the apple of my father's eye. I shall never forget his kind face, his brown eyes, looking at me with tranquil love whenever I came into the room. He often said, "Here's looking at you, kid." And it wasn't until I was in college and he was dead that I realized that he hadn't made up those words for me. Mario was his name. He knew everything. When I was in high school, I used to sit around the living room trying to think of questions to which he didn't know the answer. I couldn't. Effortlessly, he could tell me about the history of Greece, Europe, and the Middle East. He could talk about philosophy from Aristotle through the 20th century Germans. All of this he did in a graceful and unpretentious manner. His knowledge came from the pure enjoyment of learning. He was born to be a professor. In fact, his colleagues and students couldn't believe that he came from a working-class family of Sicilian immigrants. His father owned a pants-stitching shop in Queens, which my father named when he was a boy, Imperial Pants. In his youth, he was skinny and popular, a regular Italian guy running around with his friends playing pool and handball. But he also sat at home studying. He learned German during World War II, when Germans were considered the evil enemy. By the time he finished college, he was fluent in German, Italian, Sicilian, and English. Later, he learned Yiddish and spoke it so well that once when he bought the Jewish Daily Forward at a newsstand,
The Jewish man who sold it to him reprimanded him in Yiddish for being out on the Sabbath and refused to believe him when he said he was Italian. I remember seeing the foreword in a basket in the bathroom, stuck between Mad Magazine and the Renaissance Quarterly, all of which my father read with equal interest. As a child, I sat on his lap whenever I wanted to, and he never once pushed me off, told me he didn't have time. Nor did he make me go to bed when he had parties in the house, late loud gatherings of professors and students eating and drinking and singing. My father played the mandolin and the accordion, which he'd learned from his father, who'd been in a small band of Italians that played weddings and birthdays and anniversaries. He could play anything on the accordion, Never on Sunday, Amazing Grace, Mozart arias. And he played with an expression that I thought of as the daddy music face, a certain combination of concentration and delight that I never saw at any other time. Everyone adored him. They told him he looked like a cross between Cary Grant and Sean Connery. They laughed at his endless jokes, cried at his music, came to him for advice. This house, which everyone loved to visit, was full of oil paintings and oriental rugs and dark antique furniture, which my father had collected during the 1950s, when they weren't worth much, when everyone else was discovering the wonders of linoleum and brightly colored modern interiors. I spent my childhood playing liar's dice and racco, sitting on a finely upholstered European couch in front of a marble coffee table, eating on a 19th century Renaissance-style table with large-breasted angels, or were they gorgons, carved into its thick legs, running around between European paintings and prints, Chinese lamps with silk shades. The buying of these things did not come out of pretension any more than did his erudition, but rather from the same source, the love of beauty and culture. He never seemed to be anxious about anything, about his work, his students' papers, the book translations he was working on. I remember the rapid clicking of his electric typewriter in the study late at night after I went to bed. Not long ago, I got a call from a friend, a doctoral student, who told me about reading a book of philosophy translated from the German and marveling at how smoothly it read, since translations from the German are usually wordy and awkward. He turned to the title page and saw that my father had translated it. Despite his success in the largely WASP academic world of his time, my father always remained proud to be Italo-American, and he never stopped loving his Sicilian family. But they drove him crazy sometimes. His mother was a prima donna, a materialist who wore huge gold necklaces and diamond rings, and always needed to be the center of attention. His sister had wanted to be a model, but she was short and round and far too Italian for the 1950s, and she ended up marrying another Italian guy at 19 and becoming a secretary. Her husband Paul, who wasn't too bright, took over the pants shop when my grandfather retired and ran it into the ground. My father settling in the Hudson River Valley, 75 miles north of them, was, in retrospect, the only possible choice. He was still near enough to drive home for holidays, birthdays, and emergencies, but he was far enough that he could have his own life, his own friends, without their being around all the time, without his mother's imposing presence, his sister's endless chatter about nothing. For the family in Queens, our house was in the country, and it was a huge excursion to get there. They did so only once that I can remember, besides his funeral. When he started to die, it was unthinkable. No one could bear it, could believe it. Mario was too wonderful to die, too important, too good a friend to too many. He couldn't die. It was impossible. It mustn't happen. But no one could help. We sat helplessly watching as a cruel cancer shrank his body, dulled his voice to a whisper, slowed his mind. Nothing can erase the image from my mind of his sitting at the head of the table, hardly more than a skeleton, his huge eyes infinitely mournful and sweet, holding his head in his hands, trying to read the New York Times. He never got angry, never lashed out, never asked for anything we couldn't give. When he died, the world fell apart. Maybe every girl thinks her father is a great man. How can I explain to you that he actually was? I have proof. Everyone said it, not just me. Countless students of his, former students and current, were devastated, wrote me letters. One of his graduate school professors, a famous scholar at Columbia University, wrote immediately upon his death, saying that my father was the best student he'd ever had. The church at his funeral overflowed with people whom I could not see through the haze of tears and numbness. And he loved no one as much as me. Not my mother, even before the divorce. She was difficult and cool against his Latin warmth. Not his mother, though he loved her with the love of a good son. Perhaps his father, a gentle and kind man who would have liked to study in a university the way my father did. My grandfather died 6 months before my father, and it was obvious that he died in order not to witness the death of his son. But I thought my father would live. The operation was supposed to have been successful. The surgeons were ecstatic. When he decided to marry a second time, he called me on the phone. I was sitting in my dorm room, freshman year, alone on a dirty white plastic couch. He told me that although he was going to marry, I should know that I would always be numero uno. Numero uno. I tried not to let him hear that I was weeping. I think then I fully realized the fragility of his life, the hugeness of his love, and that it was all too late. What happens to that love when someone dies? His spirit is still with you, say the cliché spouting mourners, supporters, family, friends. You carry that love in your heart. No, the person is dead. His eyes are not there looking at me. His voice is not telling me about the history of Florence. He's not standing at the stove making spaghetti with meat sauce, not taking me to the supermarket and buying me whatever I want, Jiffy Pop, Milky Way bars, Barbie doll clothes. He's not there listening to stories about how hard it is to fit in at school, taking me on his lap and telling me that I'm better than those mean girls and don't worry about it. The spirit of love doesn't matter when a person is dead. It's the fact of being in the same room that matters. It's the accordion. And that was a remembrance of my father, Mario Domandi, in honor of Father's Day.